Members could take their seats.
Think about all the jobs at the airport.
To go into kindergarten.
If
good morning.
Well, Representative Petersburg, have you reviewed the minutes?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I approve them. I move the minutes as presented.
All those in favor? Representative Petersburg moves the minutes. All those in favor of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion passes. Minutes are approved. Today we have Minute Services, an overview of the budget and the governor's proposal. So without further ado, if you could state your name for the record, and please proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Thomas A. Baden, Jr., Commissioner and State CIO.
And for the record, John Eichten, Minute Legislative Director.
Thank you. So please proceed.
Thank you. We have two things to cover today, two change requests, and just a basic overview of Minute Services so you have a sense of context. Very brief. We'll be straight to the point. Minute Services is the IT entity that runs and maintains all of IT services for all 26 branch agencies and, well, about 80 other entities, all total boards and many other folks as well. It covers all things IT, including data centers, hardware, networks, middleware, productivity tools such as your desktop and all the components that are on your desktop, email, enterprise communications, and also business applications that our 26 branch agencies need to perform their business. We're responsible and accountable for all of that spectrum of work. We also supply some of our services to other Minnesota governments and entities, and including oftentimes cybersecurity services for towns, cities that need our help. So we've got a little more expanded role in that area also. Our role is setting the leadership for IT for our business areas, setting architectural and security standards and oversight, managing application life cycles, security management, and an IT portfolio management, which I'm very happy to say for the first time that I've ever seen in state government history, and I've been around here almost 33 years, we've got a complete portfolio of all of our projects and their statuses, and it's really nice to have that entire portfolio to be able to look at everything that's on our plate. Our agency is funded in a pretty straightforward way. We sing for our supper. We only have only 1% of our funding is actually allocated. 99% of our funding is a straight chargeback model. In essence, we provide IT services, you know, whether it be IT products, professional technical services. We provide that all back to the agencies in a chargeback model. So it's really a slightly different model than other agencies that have allocations. We have a roughly $430 million annual budget, and as of now, all IT purchases that were formerly done out of the 26 branch agencies are now done in a central way. So all of the IT purchases come through that direction. It really sets the context for a couple of asks that we're here for today. First off, on the cash flow front, I'll try to put together a simple analogy on cash flow. Well, what we're looking for is literally the continued authority to have a revolving fund. If you're providing information technology services for a set of agencies, often we have to buy the technology ahead of time, either utilize our staff or have professional technical services to implement product sets to execute performing technology for the agencies. And then what we do is turn around and bill the agency back. There's a period of time that the agency has that they review the invoices and then pay us back. So really that revolving fund is just a way that provides us cash flow as an agency. We've had it in place, but now that we're pulling all of the 26 branch agencies in, the number that we're looking for is $110 million of cash flow. At the end of the day, it becomes a zero net cost to the state. Because at the end of the year, when we balance our books, the invoices are paid, money comes back in, and it becomes a zero net sum.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Commissioner. If I could, we got a question, Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, I was just alerting the CLA that I'll have lots of questions. So go ahead with presentation, and we'll talk
I'll
later.
I'll wait till the end then.
Yes, sir.
Sounds good. Thank you, Commissioner. Go ahead and proceed.
Yes, sir. So the first part of it is that we just want to have permission to be able to have that cash flow fund. It's much like any other IT business in that you have an expenditure up front. You put the expenditure of the IT as well as the professional technical service together. You bill the customer. The customer reviews the bill. The bill gets paid back. It ends up as a zero net. So really, that's part one of the ask. The second is that the way the law is currently written, we need to close our books at the end of June. What we're asking for is that we close our books at the end of June. However, we allow agencies a reasonable period of time that even, you know, if they buy information technology services, say, June 15th, and we're able to get the bill out, but they can't pay their bill until July 15th, we ask that there's a reasonable time for agencies to review their invoices, do their proper due diligence, and pay the agency back and close out our books effective June 30th. It just basically puts our time clocks in sync with the rest of the agencies is what it does. Most all agencies act kind of in this time synchronicity, and we're asking that we also are able to do that at that time. Does that make sense? Okay. Any questions on that particular area? Okay, we'll go to one more. There's a second thing that we'd like to ask for, and that is that of the 99% of the agency's revenue is based on a chargeback, there is 1% that is allocated. And those fund allocations really cover our IT leadership, our information technology security, which includes support of cybersecurity for the agencies as well as branch and boards as well as some cities and states, also for geospatial, and also for 14 and 15, some project carry forward. This also would be there to cover, like I said, the 1.8% general fund compensation cost increase at a total cost of $95,000 for fiscal year 16 and $191,000 in fiscal year 17. The intent is to maintain the current levels of agency operations, and it only relates to those general fund appropriations. It doesn't support increases in any other compensation costs around the state for IT. So it's really just this small group, IT leadership, cybersecurity, geospatial.
Commissioner, could you explain who that IT leadership is? Could you are there certain positions that are in that group?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. Myself, Deputy Commissioner, Cybersecurity Assistant Commissioner, Assistant Commissioner for all projects, and a Chief Operations Officer, as well as, you know, just additional staff in the CIO office, the cybersecurity team, so the entire cybersecurity team fits in that area, as well as the geospatial group.
I think it would be important if Commissioner, if you could provide us that breakdown and how that looks to be dispersed between the different positions, I think that would...
And, Mr. Chair,
yes.
Would you like us to provide a breakdown of the staff positions within IT leadership, IT security, and geospatial?
Yeah, I think that would be important for us all to see and provide that to the committee. I think that would be great.
Great.
Yes,
thank
sir.
You. And we got a Representative Lunan, you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. One more comment. This would be an example of, I noticed in a lot of our budget where we do cash accounting instead of accrual accounting, and with the accounts receivable going over your budget period, the accrual accounting already accounts for that. I don't know if somebody in this room knows why the state doesn't operate more of their accounts on an accrual basis, and that will account for any tails when we create an FTE, for instance, with the retirement that we have to put away, all of that stuff down the road hits our books currently then rather than once they retire. And this is a classic example of that. The question I have is the your closing period, your leg, I'm assuming you're talking about like a 30-day?
Closer to a 45, but okay. That's the right idea. Yes, sir.
All right, thank you.
Okay. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple questions for the testifiers. In slide 2, you say you provide full-spectrum IT services, and you say you've got middleware, networks, hardware, data centers, but in my conversations over time, and indeed with Mr. Eichten, that's not necessarily the full complement of what you're providing. You're actually providing a little bit less than that. Is that correct?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, I'm not exactly sure what you're getting at. That we provide that full spectrum there of the image on the left. Now, it doesn't mean everything is provided by Minute staff. We utilize private sector expertise in a lot of these areas. Is that sort of the line you're going down?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Eichten, yes, that is what I was trying to get at, is that you don't own necessarily all the things that you administer. So I wanted to make sure that we clarified that for anybody who might pick this up later on. That you know, some of the storage, some of the other things that you guys are doing is not necessarily your own, and I just wanted to make sure that we provided that level of clarity for both people here in the room and for folks who may be watching.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, that's absolutely correct. I mean, for instance, our enterprise data center is a leased facility. It's a private sector-owned data center that provides services not just to the state but the federal government as well. We utilize a hybrid. It's a mix of internally provided services and then private sector. So that's absolutely correct.
Mr. Chair, a couple other questions. Thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the other questions that I had is, Mr. Eichten, you and I had talked about my desire to talk about some of the consolidation that we've done. And I guess one of the questions that I would ask is, how many people hold the title of CIO?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, we started out consolidation with 19 CIOs that were consolidated from the various agencies. We now have 12. So we've rolled in, so for instance, the education, the Department of Education CIO is now the CIO for Department of Education, Office of Higher Education, Purpose School for the Arts Education, the State Academies for the Deaf and the Blind. We recently consolidated the Department of Corrections CIO position underneath the Department of Public Safety CIO office, so that CIO serves both entities. There are a few other examples as well. DALI, the CIO for Labor and Industry, now serves the the Department of Commerce as well. So essentially we've gone from 19 to 12.
Mr. Chair, another question, follow-up to that.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So along that same line, as you know, I work in the IT industry, and very few people in an industry or in an organization have the title of CIO, and I get that we're going through a consolidation, and along that line, you and I have talked about the number of headcount that we started off with and where we are now. Is it or is it not correct that we've actually not reduced the number of headcount programmatically? We've done it sort of by attrition. And can you help us understand the programmatic reduction that you hopefully are working towards? Because, again, in a consolidation, it is always the goal to reduce the number of people doing the same thing, because, as you and I have talked about in my office, I think we used the example at the time of storage administrators. We don't need as many storage administrators when we are actually trying to consolidate and put that data on fewer boxes in a data center. So can you help me understand that? And sort of a long question, I know. I'm under-caffeinated, so I wasn't as elegant in my question asking. But can you help us kind of get to that, please?
Director or Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, across the agency the last 4 years, if you look at the last 4 years, our budget has been literally flat, except for 1 year where it dropped $6 million over the last 4 years. The people have stayed within about 76, so the staffing has stayed relatively flat. That said, consumption has gone up considerably, so we're actually doing a heck of a lot more work with the same amount of people. the complement of people also are in the midst of, at this point we have 37 data centers and we want to consolidate those down to probably five, if not less than that, over time. The work to move over thousands of applications into a virtualized set of managed services also takes effort. So it's not like you can immediately lay people off. You actually have to do the work of moving applications out of one data center and moving it into a virtualized environment in another. And so the level of effort of going through that actual consolidation where we can realize the cost benefit of putting it on managed service, doing it with less people, scaling back the attack surface and making sure that the cybersecurity is much more sound and the applications can be run more soundly is a tremendous amount of effort. A lot of the applications, as we're looking at moving them over into the virtual environments, have IPs that are hard-coded in it, for example. They just don't lend themselves real quickly to just move them over instantly. So part of the reason that we still need that full complement of people is to actually execute the work of moving into that managed hosting environment. We'll see more economies of scale over time. The rest of it is we've shifted staff out of roles such as storage and other things that we've gotten more into the consolidated mode and shifted them to other areas where we need them. So our workforce is also changing. We change over probably about 400 of our 2,100 people each year, and the skill sets are very much changing from older technologies to newer technologies. So we're really moving our way toward repurposing staff toward developing applications and solutions for our agencies. So consumption has gone up, we've kept our costs lower, and we're still in the path of consolidating those data centers and trying to gain some of those efficiencies that you're speaking of, sir.
Representative Nash?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Bowden, to the question that I'd asked regarding the number of CIOs and the consolidation of that as well, I know my question was long, but could you address that as well?
Commissioner?
Yes, we've been really practically looking at each of the CIOs, and as those folks either move on to other positions or retire, our approach has been, for that CIO, we look for lines of business that are really similar, so that the CIO can look at opportunities across multiple agencies and multiple programs. For example, I came out of Department of Human Services, and Human Services was about the size of 9 agencies. And we went through a similar consolidation at that agency before I came into this role. And really, as basic as I can say it, is there were a number of healthcare and social services that aligned together very well, and so we wanted to optimize the technology behind those programs. It was similar around public safety and corrections, where we just made that same move of consolidating that under one CIO. Many of the IT needs for both of those agencies are very, very similar, so we wanted to align that leadership behind those IT technologies that had some synergy.
Representative Nash, follow-up?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Last question for now. We've had testimony in this committee regarding some of the services that you provide to other agencies. And Mr. Eichten, you and I had talked about this, that formalized quotes have not been necessarily the practice for all requests that have been made to you. Please tell me that we're trying to address that and ameliorate that problem, because I know I met with Mr. Goldsmith yesterday, who has also said that he's put in requests for quotations, and I believe yesterday he told me he's still at 6 weeks waiting to get a quote back. And I'm just trying to understand how we're designed to serve our internal clients, and yet we're not getting to the point where we can actually serve our internal clients because Mr. Goldsmith is still waiting for a quotation.
Mr. Chair, Representative Director. Nash, to clarify, Mr. Goldsmith is the director of the Campaign Finance Board, which is not part of IT consolidation. I'm aware of his request for a quote for service costs, and it actually relates to a service that, due to consolidation, we're considering whether we want to or whether it makes sense to provide that outside of the consolidated entities, outside of that scope of groups anymore. So there has been a delay in getting him that quote as we internally make that call. There, in the past, OET, which is now Minute, has provided services to cities, counties, higher education entities, school districts. And the question is, now that we have a new charge and a new mission in terms of serving the executive branch, We'll certainly continue to provide network service and forensics and security support, such as what Mr. Boozy's team does for cities and counties when they need it. But should we be in the business of providing hosting services to cities and counties? Those are the questions that we're trying to answer right now. And as I understand it, that's Mr. Goldsmith's request relates to hosting services and whether what Minute would charge for that. And we just haven't made a call as to whether that should be part of our core mission anymore, providing outside of the entities that the legislature has chosen to be part of consolidation. And Campaign Finance Board is not one of those entities.
So. Representative Nash?
Be brief and follow up on that. I guess, again, the question that I asked regarding formalized quotations to anyone, I still didn't hear an answer to that.
Let me take that.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair. We're right now, we're about 3 years into switching over our financial system. This year, it is my intent and my goal to move to enterprise rates so that rates are flat across all 26 agencies. Therefore, any one of the folks that are serving a particular agency, including the CIO, could literally go into the product set and put together a quotation almost instantly. We're hoping to have that implemented this year. So by the end of June, we'll have standard rates for pretty much everything in our service pack. And that's part of the way I want to address getting those quotes faster and easier and having the CIOs and or their teams be able to get to the pricing quicker.
Mr. Chair, in the interest of time, I will be quiet for a while.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Howell. My question isn't quite as nuanced or detailed. I'm trying to understand a couple of terms, so if I just explain it to a regular person, they don't know what the heck I was talking about. I don't quite understand. I understand IT security, but when you say IT leadership, I don't quite understand what you're talking about, and I don't quite understand geospatial. Could you say a little bit about what those things are and how they play in the work you're doing?
First off, on the IT leadership front, it's myself. Someone's got to be in charge of the IT organization. And my core team, which is a deputy commissioner, an operations, communications, and security and contracts, as well as operations person. There's also human resources. We've got to do human resource management for our couple thousand people. We've got to do financials, so doing financials for all of our staff. Now doing all of the procurement of IT and all of the contracting with all of the private industry vendors that we procure from. So it's really all of those roles are part of the leadership team. Cybersecurity includes functions such as engineering systems to make sure that they're safe, making sure that patch levels are up, making sure there's border defenses so people don't get in. Looking at applications, new applications that are created, and looking through the code to make sure that there's no holes in that code that people can break through and do us harm. So there's many roles within the cybersecurity area.
And what I, go ahead,
Representative Down.
And I would just add, we do have your Assistant Commissioner Jesse Ullman, who's part of that IT leadership group in terms of project and initiative management and oversight. So setting standards for the state in terms of, as well as Mr. Boozy setting standards for the state for agencies to follow in terms of security, accessibility of technology by those who have disabilities, and then project management, aligning the approach to project management across agencies, and that's something that I'm sure either of those guys would be happy to answer questions on if you have them.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And these aren't trick questions, it's just trying to get information. Geospatial, what does that mean? That you're working on geospatial.
If you could state your name and title for the record, please.
Sure. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Christopher Boozy. I'm an Assistant Commissioner and Chief Security Officer for the state of Minnesota. One of the areas that I do oversee is geospatial technologies. When the legislature brought together the Office of Enterprise Technology, which is now Minute Services, one of the things that the legislature chose to do is move the geospatial function, which was formerly a standalone entity and part of then later the part of the Department of Administration. They brought that into our fold, basically to put all technology under one roof. One of the things that that geospatial technology does, it refers to all the technology stack that's really location-based. And in a world of smartphones, what you're finding is location-based technologies are more and more important. They're used in quite a few different ways throughout the executive branch today, and they're also used to provide opportunities for private businesses as well. And I'll give you a couple examples. So, for example, in times of crisis, one of the things that the geospatial group does is they take high-resolution aerial imagery of the entire state of Minnesota, and that's high-resolution photos at, I believe it's an 8-inch square. So from the public safety perspective, those tools and technologies are really valuable in times of for example, like flooding and crisis for emergency responders. Geospatial technologies are going to be a core component of the next generation 911 systems that are being put in place. The premise behind it is when somebody calls 911 from a smartphone now, there's got to be a way for first responders to know exactly where they are. So built into those next-gen 911 system are maps of the streets and the cities and locations and schools and train tracks and a lot of other components. They're all layers that are part of those systems. So a lot of those geospatial technologies today are used by various agencies such as DOT for road building, DNR for managing lands and waterways. But on the private sector as well, all of this data is put together and it's made available through a public resource called the Minnesota Geospatial Commons. And it's an asset to the private sector as well. So, for example, I'm aware that the placement of wind farms in southern Minnesota are based on some of the plat maps that are published through our organization, as well as height data that's published as well, called elevation data or LIDAR data that's out there as well. So there's lots of different uses of that data. Realtors and surveyors use that data. So our group manages all that data as a benefit to the public sector, the private sector. The good news story, though, is that in the past it was managed agency by agency, group by group, and now it's being put together in the Minnesota Geospatial Commons. And there's even several uses right now where the legislature is taking advantage of that as bills are passed and different programs are adopted for bills. The Minnesota Geospatial Group is allowing that to be presented on maps so that policymakers can see how bills impact their districts. So I hope that wasn't too long of an answer.
No, I appreciate that help to explain what it was. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Albright.
Mr. Bosey, I just have a follow-on question. And you possess an incredible amount of pretty important and pretty important data, just as you said, with the geospatial and knowledge of locations of certain functions of government or functions of the electrical grid or what have you. So my first question to you would be, how are you protecting our data? What measures are you taking? And you can be as proud as you want.
Mr. Chair, committee members, that is just a huge question, and it could go on for several hearings. But I guess I'd like to start by saying that the state of Minnesota has a comprehensive security program that has lots of preventive controls in that program. We look at cybersecurity as a complete set of services. It's kind of like saying, what is a doctor? But we have services that are out there to protect state data. Those are things like the various access control services we have in place to limit logical access to data. We have physical controls in place. We have a lot of sophisticated technologies that we use today so that every piece of data and every system that's part of government, we do ongoing what are called vulnerability scans of government systems. So on a daily basis, we run approximately 30,000 computerized jobs that go out and we scan all the technology that's part of state government. We look for any exploitable weaknesses in those systems, which come about daily today as hackers find new weaknesses. And our job is to assess the state government to find and fix those kind of problems before they can actually become exploited. We have tools in place that actually take different events from across different government systems, and we put them together in a sophisticated technology system which correlates the events, and we're trying to find the needles in the haystack. So we have the preventive controls. We also have detective controls as well. We have intrusion detection systems. We have sophisticated monitoring systems that are in place. And then finally, there's the corrective processes that are in place as well. Despite the best efforts that government has, everybody knows that events happen. So we have comprehensive processes for dealing with incidents that happen on a day-to-day basis. And also we help government agencies develop testable recovery strategies for disaster recovery. So it's a very broad question that you ask, and we have a comprehensive program to address all of those different issues. I think one of the things that I'm excited about today, though, is that with the legislation that was passed, bringing MNIT together under one roof for the entire executive branch, it gives us the opportunity to put this program in place where it can really be done well. And as Mr. Baden talked about, managed hosting, for example, and a lot of other core services that are being developed by MNIT Services, the thing that is appealing to me as the security leader for our state, it provides a golden opportunity for us to finally get cybersecurity right and to start baking those services into things like managed hosting out of the gate, because the old model where it was done agency by agency, there just wasn't enough money on the table to ever do what needs to be done in the world that we have today where we have so many bad actors.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative Albright.
Commissioner Baden, I just have a follow-up question. To your first slide, you mentioned that MMB is permissive of what constitutes an operating loan of $110 million. And further down in the bullets, it talks about that authority requires repayment by the close of the biennium. And you're asking for a change in the repayment deadline. And so my question goes to the point of in what instances is repayment delayed? And not that we have agencies that are delinquent or bad payers on their debt, but I'm trying to appreciate from your perspective what instances, and maybe Mr. Bosey spoke to it in terms of coordination of group purchasing where you're installing it at various commission agencies and their installation may waver in terms of completion dates, that type of thing, and maybe I'm answering my most questions so you can help me out there. But and then just to your final bullet point in terms of the centralized procurement associated, are there hard closes that you have to? When is the hard close on the books for your agency as well as others? Are they in synchronous geospatial, you know, specialness? If you could just speak to those. I'm not a geek.
Commissioner.
Well,
you can phone a geek.
Madam Chair and committee members, generally how we want to close out the books at the end of the year is we put a soft close on all IT procurement right about the middle of May so we can close out our books by the end of June. However, inevitably, there's going to be something that comes along that an agency needs an IT purchase of some nature. So we try to close our books on the schedule, you know, by the end of the month, but I would say there's not been a year that's gone by that there's a critical project need or a critical device or a critical IT move that has to be done sometime in June. What it allows us to do is go ahead and execute on that, put together the invoice, give the agency a reasonable amount of time to review the invoice for correctness, pay it back, but then we would still close out the books by the end of the year. So our hard close is closer to mid-June, but we do a softer close. We try to wrap everything up by mid-May, but IT, it just happens all year long. So it really allows us the mechanism to go ahead and serve our agency partners and give them just a reasonable time to get their invoice paid. It's as simple as that.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, I guess the question I had earlier, they talked about, Representative Nash asked about reducing staff and you know, consolidate everybody. Why aren't we shedding people off? And you said that you're increasing the workload, increasing the things that are you doing. As we reduce staff or do this, are we relying more and more on outside consultants and outside contractors to do this work? And I guess how does that affect our security if we're relying more and more on people from outside the agency and outside state employment? Doesn't that open us up to hackers getting in through a back door, similar to what happened in some of the breaches and major companies that have happened in the last few years, Target being a main one? That sounds like somebody got in through a back door from an outside contractor of theirs and got into their system. Does this leave, you know, relying more and more on outside contractors, does it leave us more at a security risk?
Yeah,
Commissioner, or Mr. Boozy?
Madam Chair and Representative, it is a very good question. We're in any organization in IT right now is going to, you know, whether it be a private industry or government is going to have some sort of balance of private consulting and core state staff. So that's going to be fairly normal. And what we need to do as an IT organization is mitigate and manage that very carefully. Part of what we've done on many major projects now, especially developers, is we put together virtual environments that are controlled by the state so that if a contractor were to come in and write code, for example, that environment is battened down very tight. So the development is done here and that the code is reviewed here. When we review that software, we've got a security lifecycle that any new software that's built and put in place goes through a very strict review, including a review of all the code to assure that those back doors are all battened up very tightly. All of that is part of the software delivery life cycle, and it's baked in many steps along the way, so we don't allow those back doors at any time. There is always going to be balance, though, of having private partners and state partners just for capacity purposes and sometimes for competencies. You know, sometimes we just don't have a skill set in a certain area and we have to hire for it. We have to manage around that. We have to control those risks very carefully.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if Mr. Boozman, it sounds like, it looks like he has a comment or on it, or was that?
Yes. Mr. Boozy.
Madam Chair, committee members, I think one thing that's important to recognize is that, you know, the very nature of IT today is that people don't do everything on their own. There's organizations in the private sector that specialize in certain areas, and the state, just like every other organization, tries to look at what we do in relation to what's available in the private sector and source technology solutions so that it best meets the needs of the customers and the state as a whole as cost effectively as possible. So, for example, the state of Minnesota has an arrangement with Microsoft where we have Microsoft provide the back end of all the messaging services for state government. We have about 45,000 mailboxes that are managed by our partner Microsoft. So the thing that's important with any type of outsourcing arrangement is that we don't shed the risk. So we still own the risk of using a provider. So the question is, how do you manage the risk? So part of the thing that our internal security team does, whether we build it on-prem or whether we use vendor providers, we have to go through an assessment process and validate the controls of our vendor, make sure that the vendor has the right controls in place, and we also make the vendor attest to those controls contractually. So I just recently completed the negotiation with Microsoft for new services, and we make Microsoft go on record in the contract and say, okay, not only do you have the controls, but we're going to hold you liable for those controls contractually. And in the case of Microsoft, there's also other controls in that environment where we make them go through certain audit processes where we can actually have independent validation of those controls. So it's a great question, but it's all a matter of how risk is managed appropriately in today's IT world.
Well, I don't think we want to get into the debate of emails, so given recent things. Representative Nelson, follow
up. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess the other question I have in my mind here has been, is with the discussion's been going on, and what you talk about contracting out. I come from a construction background, and contractors make that to choices every day, whether I'm going to do this job or with my people are contracted out. And so I understand a little bit about what you're talking about there. So the other question I had to do with the question Representative Nash asked about the campaign finance board. How are you making those decisions about what stuff you're going to do and what stuff you're not going to do? I mean, the legislature didn't mandate campaign finance board to come into your IT. You know, how do you make that decision? Is it based on staff capacity, the expertise of the people you have? How do you make that decision whether we're going to take on this type of work that is not part of our core mission?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, we make those decisions really carefully because we're a not-for-profit organization. So our first priority is to our 26 branch agencies, and that's what we've been really carefully weighing is how much can we do and do well, and what are the things that we can do outside of the branch agencies. And that's I'm not trying to build a huge fiefdom here. I don't want to be IT for everybody. What we want to do is we want to do information technology very well for our 26 branch agencies. So we've been wrestling with where is that line, and just trying to carefully walk through that and make the right choices so we can focus on quality and service delivery and cost and cybersecurity for our branch agencies. That's
Representative Nelson.
Thank you.
To that point, Commissioner, can you tell me how many contracts IT Minute has for cities, counties, and school districts?
Madam Chair, I'm going
to... Mr. Boozy?
Madam Chair, committee members, obviously we're going to have to get back to you with the numbers so that we don't... testify misinformation today, but there's two types of contracts essentially. There's contracts where cities and counties actually are getting services from Minute, so that's one of the things. I think that's probably what you're looking at. But also there's other arrangements as well that are in play. So when the state of Minnesota and Minute Services contracts with vendors to provide services, along with cities and counties coming into Minute to use services that we provide. We also look out for their best interests as well, and we extend those contracts to those entities so that they can buy off those contracts. So, for example, in the past, if a city or some smaller local government entity wanted to go out and procure goods and services, for example, for encryption is one I'm familiar with, they obviously wouldn't be able to get the pricing that the state of Minnesota as a whole would get as a consolidated entity. So we also have contracts that are available for them to procure off of so that they can get the aggressive rates that we get when we negotiate for government as a whole. So we will get back to you on the contracts that we have with our customers, but I wanted to explain that there's two sides to that question as well.
And Mr. Boozy, I want data for both. So I want both the service contracts, and I would also like the data for the contracts with vendors where we're offering the services that we access as a state. And I'd also like to see it from a historical perspective. So how aggressive has the agency itself become now more aggressive in going out for those contracts, and what has that meant? And then also the amount of time. From an FTE perspective, how much time is the agency then spending for both of these two sets of contracts? So those that are the service contracts as well as the contracts with the vendors that we're offering to those entities. So I'd like to look at it from those two different angles, but in particular, how much time are we spending? I think that would be very helpful. And then what percentage does that amount of time then consume over your overall pie of the services that you offer as an entire agency overall. So if you could get that to me, I will make sure that the rest of the committee can have that as well. I also wanted to talk to you, Mr. Boozy, about the geospatial portion of things. If I remember correctly, I believe it was just 2 years ago, Representative Wagenius, she was the chair of the Environment Finance Committee, and one of the things that she was very eager to do was kind of the geospatial mapping, if I'm remembering correctly. Are you accessing those funds then as part of your geospatial component of IT, or how are those resources from the different agencies being shared with Minute, or are you now expending dollars on top of what has already been allocated to these agencies and we're doubling up on the effort?
Madam Chair, committee members, to start with the last part first, there is no doubling up of effort. What is going on with the geospatial community is that we are working to take the existing spend and use that existing spend more efficiently. Most of the spend today that is for geospatial is done through through rates. So the services are provided. Our agency customers pay for those services. For example, the DOT has geospatial services they get that they receive so that they can, you know, do street center lines and those kind of things that they need for their engineering and to manage their roadways. There is a small portion of general funding that is available as well for geospatial services. I believe that appropriation is about $800,000, and that is a lot of the geospatial work that's used to help put the data together and to manage those services that are made broadly available. I call them more of the citizen-facing services. It's to help, you know, real estate folks and all other people to get that data. And as I mentioned, that's where to build economy of scale, rather than having surveyors and other folks go to all different individual government agencies and counties to get their data. Our vision for the future, which is now well underway, the first version is out there, is to have what's called the Minnesota Geospatial Commons, where people can come to one place, and today I believe we have about 80 different data layers out there where people can see everything from late maps to plats to all the different types of location-based layers all in one place with tools in order to view that data.
Well, maybe, Mr. Boozy, the doubling up isn't necessarily the right term, but what are we doing to make sure that by adding the component of Minute into it, that we are not consuming the resources that have already been allocated for this, and then we're going to have to come back and fund it some more because you're adding another component to it? Are you making sure that it's going to be cohesive and this isn't a situation because that we're going to run short because we added Minute to the mix?
Madam Chair, committee members, I think you can feel confident that that is not going to happen. If you look back and you see the real purpose of why there was bipartisan legislation for IT consolidation, because running all these types of technologies, agency by agency by agency, everybody having their own servers, their own systems, no standards across the board, that was what was inefficient. So what Minute is trying to do here is to provide management rigor. And in areas where we did things multiple times with multiple systems, we're trying to do consolidation. We're trying to have one way of doing things where we can manage individual technologies that are more standardized. And the goal is to do that without raising the cost, to use the existing spend more efficiently, and also to do it more securely so that we can put things together and really run them with the level of technical rigor as well.
Well, and to that point, Mr. Boozy, I've gotten a lot of feedback from all different folks that have interactions with Minute. And one, I'm not going to name names, but one gave me a very good example of the steps prior to the consolidation being two, and the steps after consolidation being this long for accessing IT services. And though I totally get the intent of, you know, standardizing procedures and so forth, after you've kind of gone through kind of the growing pains of the consolidation, are you guys now going back and looking at how can we streamline this more and not make it so bureaucratic, if I can say that? What are you doing to try and now follow up with those entities? I know you have a separate feedback group, but I don't think that there is a sense that the feedback is working. So what are you guys kind of doing to try and address the next step going forward? And I don't know if that's for you or if it's for the commissioner.
Madam Chair, I'll let the commissioner speak this, but I can assure you that the goal of MNIT isn't to make things bureaucratic. The goal of MNIT is to streamline, to make things as efficient as possible, to run technology better than we have in the past as a state, and to run it more cost effectively. Those are the overarching goals. And some of the processes that were formerly the easy types of processes in the past, what we found is that often they didn't have the right controls, they didn't have the right security that need to be in place. So some organizations, there's going to have to be some change. I think what you see is people are often uncomfortable with change, but our goal is to be efficient from a technology perspective, to be cost-effective, and to make this an experience that our customers enjoy working with. And I'll let Mr. Baden address the question.
Well, and Mr. Boozy, you know, I totally get that, and I know the position that you guys are in. I am very sympathetic because I know that people don't like change. I think maybe what might be helpful is if you guys can give me an example of maybe a $5,000 purchase versus a major ticket item purchase, and the difference between the two versions of what steps do you have to go through if you are asking for a $5,000 purchase versus a significant purchase. And if you can kind of give us an example, and maybe that will give us a better idea of kind of your inner process and system that you work with, and we can kind of go from there. Commissioner, I don't know if you wanted to comment to this at all. If not, if you don't have to. I have a whole other list of questions as well. So
I want to go to, I think, what is part of your underlying question, and just kind of having an agency hat on and now this role hat on, and I've watched it from both sides of the fence. When you're working in an agency in the previous pre-consolidation model, in many ways it was more nimble and it was more agile. You could trot downstairs and talk to your server person or whatever and just say, spin this up, get it done. However, what that led to was 37 data centers. Well, for example, when we went through the consolidation of our IT at DHS, we had something like 5,000 servers running at 5% capacity. It was the most ridiculous waste of IT that I've ever seen. We immediately went on let's consolidate all the servers into a virtual environment. We optimized those. We put security patches on. We put rigor. And actually, folks at that point would look at it and go, well, now you slowed us down because I can't run over to Best Buy and buy a server and put another one in. So the bad news is that maybe it took a little bit more effort to get to the point where we had a whole virtualized environment. But now if you need server space, we can spin it up in a matter of minutes. It's more secure. It's much more cost effective. The security surface is substantially reduced. And that shift took us really about 4 years to really shift the culture mm-hmm. at DHS, which had 8 major divisions, and we're going through the same thing just on a larger scale right now. It takes time for folks to adjust to those processes. It takes an agency of our size, of MNIT size, to get good at it. We're utilizing a lot of our technical partners as well to help us get better at it and to increase our speed and increase our effectiveness. And I even just look right now at our managed hosting offering, and it's not going in as quickly as I would like to see it go in. Mm-hmm. However, it's going in securely, stably. We're trying to make sure that we build the base really well, so as we move all those environments in, it's clean and it's crisp, it's solid, it's stable, secure. Once we get past that, make sure we've got it, we can accelerate it from many agencies in, and we can hone that down. My answer is we need to improve at it. Okay. But we are working it very diligently, and I've seen firsthand the results.
Okay. Mr. Boozy, you wanted to comment to that?
Madam Chair, committee members, and one more thing I think it's important to point out is that as policymakers, I'm sure you hear individual instances where things are perceived as not going as well due to the consolidation efforts that are underway. But I think it's also important to realize that there's a lot of things that are going well that you don't hear about on a day-to-day basis. And, you know, to give you the one example, when we look at the way technology was managed in the past with, you know, kind of the wild, wild west approach where everybody kind of was out there doing their own thing, there's tremendous efficiencies that are gained as we start to put these processes together. I'll give you one example since I oversee the strategic procurement for our state. In the past, with Adobe goods and services, we had people that went out and bought whatever they wanted, however they wanted. It was difficult to manage just the licenses. It was very chaotic. And we replaced that process where there was probably over 1,000 individual transactions a year buying onesie, twosie types of solutions with one enterprise contract for Adobe. We pay them one time per year. So one contract for the entire government. We don't have 1,000 individual accounting transactions that cost $100 a piece. People just check out the software. We have one portal that can manage the entire Adobe world, and people get what they need quickly without a contracting process at all. So, Madam Chair, committee members, there's good examples that are out there that you don't hear about that offset a lot of those other examples as well, and I just wanted to point that out as well today.
And Mr. Boozy, I recognize that, and probably about half of the things that are told to me I don't even mention to you because I know that it's, you know, I know that change is difficult for people. But the things that I do mention to you rise to the level of concern, and that I just want to share it with you because I'm sure you'd want to rather have the feedback from us than to not get the feedback at all and then something change without you having the opportunity to provide input. So with that, I have a kind of changing gears a little bit. You guys now are full in on the Minsure issue. And I'm wondering, can you tell us, in your view, what went wrong?
I think the biggest thing was timing. When, as CIO at Human Services, we watched, we were engaged, we were a part of it. When I became first involved, it was November, it was less than a year before go live, and vendors were just coming on board. A system that does complex eligibility, financials, an insurance portal, one that is required to have the level of security, the level of compliance and auditability, interfaces with a federal hub that were tremendously complex, a set of shifting rules that software needed to be built against that were shifting over the course of the summer all the way going into August before an October 1st go live. Even with bringing in some of the best IT vendors that were available, it was impossible to do in that period of time. Managing the scope against that time frame was difficult for everybody. I actually watched if you have a chance to go out and watch Mikey, who was at Google and came to work for the Federal Exchange. He does a presentation on it. I would encourage you to take a look at his overview of how the federal rollout went. A lot of similar issues. It was a really tight time frame to do a very, very highly complex project, and with changing requirements over the summer, it caused late delivery of the software because what they were building against was changing over the course of the whole summer, which caused not enough time for doing testing. If there wasn't enough time to do, you know, if you get the software late because the requirements or the federal law interpretation was changing over the course of the summer and the software comes late, there's not enough time to test it. Therefore, the quality of the software is just not going to be good. There were a few things, though, I do want to point out that went okay. One of the smart things that I believe we did admit it in our participation with them. As we said, we looked at cloud services, we looked at infrastructure, and we said, let's reuse a stack of infrastructure that we have. So things such as load balancers, firewalls, routers, switches, data centers, databases, Oracle Rack clusters, high availability, middleware services. So all of that technology was available that we reused. That all came up on time, on budget. And by the way, over the course of, as I came back around the Christmas time after the go-live, and I watched the Minute Team, I remember one morning that we had literally the state CIO and four assistant commissioners in a room looking at all of the underpinning infrastructure and going, that's not the problem. The problem was the software. The software it came late because the requirements came late and it just didn't get fully tested.
So when you say the requirements, so are you talking about the federal timeline that was unrealistic, or give me a little more details on what you mean on the timing piece of it?
It was mainly that, you know, there was much law that was written, and all of that needed interpretation. So generally in large software development in government, what happens is the law comes out, then policy people look at that law and go, what does that law mean in a practical algorithm that means someone's eligible or not, or someone's eligible for tax credits or not? Those interpretations were coming out literally right through, literally in August. So major interpretations of that law were coming from the feds in July and August, which didn't allow the software vendors time to deliver those policies in code.
Okay. Well, talk to me about moving forward. Minute being fully engaged now, you've got the RFPs for 2015. Are we going to be able to achieve all those goals laid out for the RFPs by the end of 2015?
Realistically, when I look at where we're at right now, I mean, we're in March, open enrollments. You know, we've my understanding is that 2015 we have this grant funding available to execute on the project. We've sat down with our business partners and went exactly what needs to be accomplished, and there's a lot of things that need to be accomplished. When I look at the scope of that work, I don't think realistically that all of that work is going to be accomplished in a year. I just don't think as many people as you could put on a software project, numbers of people don't always mean that you can execute a complex delivery. A lot of it, yes. The planning effort on that is going on literally as we speak, and would you like to
add a little bit to that? And I apologize, I forgot your name. If you could state your name for the record and who you...
For the record, Jesse Oman, Assistant Commissioner with Minute Services. I oversee projects and initiatives. I know that we touched on this a little bit earlier around bringing standards and raising those standards around project management, project oversight, and ultimately our ability to execute. One other thing I would add that I see shifted in particular with the MNsure project, and I think the OLA did a great job of laying out a lot of the points of what went wrong in the different areas, is around governance and project structure and the ability to make sure that we're not trying to just run on the fly or be in a firefighting mode. I think that was actually quoted in the report. But that there is a steering committee and that there is governance and that decisions are going up and down. And I'd like to add to the commissioner's comments, you know, going into this year, one of the things that we are going to make sure is that we are being realistic, upfront, and transparent in what can be done, what can be accomplished. I know that there is a long list of what we'd like to do, and we are working with our partners in that prioritization to make sure that they are communicating to us as their IT providers what their priority is. It is our responsibility and our goal and what we will deliver on to say, and this is what that takes, and this is what we can do and what we can deliver on, and make sure that that is very clear and that we are being upfront with it.
And Mr. Ullman, we appreciate that. I think that's going to be more helpful moving forward. Commissioner, when do you think that it will be fully built out and functional?
Madam Chair, early on, when I first kind of set my eyes on reading those 17,000 pages. I did that one weekend, and, I sat and looked at it and went, how big a project is this? My first estimate was this is 3 years to get a base, to get a good solid base. And I think that's actually when I stated that very early on, but I also heard from the federal exchange folks the other day that they believe it's going to take them another 2 years to get to a good base as well.
And given that, what will the spend be to get to that 3 years base? You've got some extra money from the feds. What beyond that dollar amount will it take?
Looking at the grant funding, Madam Chair and committee members, in looking at the grant funding and the way the structure of what would be necessary from professional technical services, other additional software, any architectural changes that need to be put in place to make sure that it's very stable, the grant funding that's there looks very sufficient to me.
For the remaining 3 years, then?
For the remainder of the build-out of the project. From that point...
Okay, I just want to make sure that we're on the same page. So when you say the build-out, meaning the 3 years to get to a good base?
Correct. Assuming that a year is already under our belt.
Okay.
And to make that point even a little clearer, when I look at the original go-live going into 10-1, there was really, from what I can count, about 7 months of actual development. And then after the go-live, Minsure paused to look back, which I think they rightfully should have. They did. Everyone stopped and looked back and went, is this the right platform? Is these the right technologies? Did we do the right thing? Are we on the right path? Went through a real significant study with Deloitte.
And Optum.
And then the project started back up again really in July. So another 6 months. So really we've only had about a year of actual real development time. I think there's a couple more years of solid development time to go yet.
And Commissioner, is this going to require additional FTEs, or what are we talking about for the agency? Or is it going to be achievable within the staffing parameters that you have right now? And let me ask you this. Because they're not under our jurisdiction, do they have their own IT then? Are you bringing them into Minute? How does that work?
So,
but to the first question, yeah, Mr. Oman.
Sorry, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Actually, the IT that is within Minsure is Minute employees. So
okay.
Part of the exemptions were around a lot of oversight, but they weren't necessarily fully excluded from that consolidation. So those are Minute employees right there. As far as the staffing model, we're looking at a three-pronged approach, like you do with most modern large IT projects. We will look to reallocate internal staff that we have today, especially those with good business knowledge around public programs and that history and the ability to be able to bring that knowledge there. We will leverage outside resources and partners, especially ones with specific skill sets that might potentially be deeper than ours or to be able to supplement what we have. And we will have new positions posted, though, with the nature of where we're at, those are going to be temporary and classified for now, which gives us a lot of flexibility going forward as far as the permanency or non-permanency of those roles.
And Mr. Oman, if you can kind of give me greater details on that, if you can just shoot me an email with those details, that would be helpful too.
Madam Chair, I'll be happy to.
Okay. Members, thank you for your patience. I'm going to go to the people that have not spoken yet, and I've got Representative Khan.
Yes. Well, Madam Chairman, sorry I was a little late this morning, but one of the things, you have a bill that's coming to your committee yesterday from GovOps, which is puts Minsure, takes the exemptions for Minsure and gets rid of them and puts them back into Minute. And a piece that I passed out at that committee, which I'm sure we can get for this one, is the press release from the governor's office, which shows that the consolidation saved $27 million over the first 3 years. It's probably now up to over $30 million. And I think that was a significant, you know, for something that was very difficult to do, I think that was a significant first 3 years process. And, of course, I always like seeing Mr. Boozy here because It's another example of the executive branch ripping off the legislature. He was legislative auditor trained, and he did all our security stuff for that group, and then they, of course, took him away from us.
We train them, they steal them, right?
Yes.
Yes. All right. I've got Representative Nash.
Madam Chair, thank you. Mr. Boozy, if you'd come on down. And while you're coming, Commissioner, let me say I was pleased when you answered Representative Nelson's question to hear that you are a virtualized environment, because that does limit security risks, and I'm pleased to hear that. You know, and that sort of helped make the point that I was trying to make. Mr. Boozy, if you could, you've heard me ask a few critical questions, but I'm going to give you a couple of attaboys and ask you some questions regarding that. So the geospatial, my background that got me into IT is in GIS, and I'm pleased to hear that we've got essentially you just described a GIS without calling it a GIS. So am I correct that you've got cadastral, E911, Tiger files wrapped up into that? Are you also making it available to places like MnDOT for pavement management programs so that they can actually store as a layer in the GIS the pavement index score of that and things like that? So help me understand the GIS that you've built using the photogrammetric information that we've got. Are you making that available to all the other agencies? And then as a follow-up on that, since I'm good at packing questions together, are you also going to be making that available to counties and cities? Because when I was mayor in Waconia, we had a partnership with the county that we had control of and we would allocate funds for. And I just want to be able to answer that, because I see that as a potentially problematic for cities and counties from having the person on board that they can actually create a work ticket with and get it done quickly.
Mr. Boozy?
Madam Chair, committee members, once again, that's a big question. So I'll start with the availability of the geospatial commons. So the geospatial commons is built today. It is a one-stop hosting platform where any government agency that has geospatial data, either for their internal needs or for external citizen-facing needs, to put that data out there and make it available. Our goal as Minute Services is to host all geospatial data in that one spot to promote consistency, data sharing, and cost effectiveness. So that, I believe, was the first part of the answer to the question. The second part is a little bit more complicated. Actually, the second part about 911, our hope is to be able to use the existing infrastructure to host as much of that data as we possibly can in one spot. The 911 project is just underway right now, and there's technical considerations that are going to have to come into play here. So, for example, it's going to be really, really important for them to have very good street center lines, and that kind of data is not put together by one organization. The state has data for state highways. Cities and localities have their own centerline data. All this data gets put together by our team and published. The question is, given the needs of the 911 system, can they directly access that data out of the commons, or do we have to actually have a process to move that into the 911 system? Some of those technical data's technical issues need to be figured out as part of the project. But to go back to your question, the goal is to share as much infrastructure as we can, and obviously to publish the data and as few times as possible to avoid synchronization type of issues. Then the final part of the question dealt with what are we doing with counties and cities, and that's a little bit more challenging. As most people know, counties and cities also maintain geospatial data, and it's a challenge for counties and cities because not only is the data difficult and expensive to gather and manage, but geospatial is one of those areas that has very, very expensive tools. And so when I got into this area and really started overseeing geospatial, I was just kind of flabbergasted by the pricing of the tools that we use today for this to manage geospatial data. The primary vendor in the space is called Esri,
as I'm sure you probably know. But the way I describe it is, you know, in my house, my wife buys blinds. And I can't understand why it costs like $2,000 to put blinds in a room when I look at them and it seems like it should be $400. But it is. And that's kind of the way I look at it with some of these software vendors. I don't think there's a lot of competition in the market and they do it really well. So in a sense, no matter how hard we negotiate, I don't feel like the you never walk away feeling like you get a really good value. So going back to the cities and counties, you know, the cities and counties, which have very small organizations, they also have to buy these expensive tools as well in order to manage this data. So geospatial is a costly area for them. So what we're hoping to do with the geospatial commons is we'd like to get to the point where we tell cities and counties, we have this one-stop environment that's built and managed by the states. You know, if you don't want to manage your own geospatial data anymore, we need that data anyway for systems like 911, and plats are used by the Department of Revenue for taxation. Come up and share your data, host that data in the geospatial commons, and you can get out of the business of managing and hosting geospatial data on your own. And by the way, the commons has the tools built in too that people can use. So that's the pitch that we're making right now, you know, with these organizations, that it'll probably be better off for all of government if we figure out better ways to collaborate. There's been some legislation changes that allow us to gather city and local data because it is needed for systems like 911. But it's a long story behind geospatial, but I think it's a good story for our state, the direction we're going as well.
I'm going to jump in a little bit on that piece then. So have you had cities and counties that have offered up their geospatial data to start in that process?
We are well underway right now. So there's a process underway in order to prepare data for the for next-gen 911, where data is now being actively gathered by members of the MnGeo team. And that data needs to be normalized because there's differences in the way local governments do this because there hasn't been standards.
Yeah.
But the data is coming in. It's being normalized with the goal of publishing a lot of the necessary base layers for 911 in the commons consistently.
Okay. Representative Nash.
Madam Chair, Mr. Bruzzi, thank you for providing an answer longer than my question for the first time today, because I'm guilty of being a little long in the tooth in the questions. But so ESRI, or Earth Systems Resource Institute, is a privately owned organization run by Mr. Dangermond.
Yep.
Good guy. I met him when I was in grad school. You know, it's a little more expensive because they do provide an awful lot of tools, and it's a lot like any other private organization. They have to sell their projects at a prevailing rate. But you know, I guess my question, I would love to sit down and go through that with you and have you provide exactly the roadmap and things that you're going to be providing in that, you know, from lacustrine layers to other riparian stuff to political boundaries, how this is going to plug into redistricting and all those things, because the GIS is an immeasurably powerful tool. Is that on the roadmap, that sort of stuff, or not?
Mr. Bruzzi?
Madam Chair, committee members, I think it'd be a wonderful opportunity to have our leader come in, Mr. Dan Ross, and give you an overview of the geospatial commons for those of you that would want to see it, because I think it's a phenomenal resource, and it's a win for how we manage geospatial in our state. So I think it's a phenomenal resource from that perspective. But also, this is one of those areas that truly is an asset to businesses in the state of Minnesota as well. For people like land surveyors that have to go to all these individual counties and cities and organizations to do their jobs, to get plat information, there's a different way that we can look at this as government. So you can never imagine all the ways that putting stuff together, that innovation can happen in the private sector if we think things through a little bit better on how we deliver IT in government.
Representative Nash.
Madam Chair, I'm betting it'll be a nerd constituency meeting of one, just me. But if you all are interested, it is it's a very powerful tool. And with that, I have no further questions.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just quick jump back to contract for services. Since you've been consolidated now for an IT service for 3 or 4 years, have you done an assessment or have give me some numbers on the extent to which the contract for services for IT has increased or decreased?
Commissioner? Mr. Eichmann?
You know, Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, I don't have any numbers with me today in terms of a net increase or decrease. It's really a case-by-case determination, I think, as Mr. Boozy was discussing. It's looking at the needs of the state. How unique are the needs? Is there an off-the-shelf product or vendor solution that a vendor can implement for us that's going to be cost-effective? Or is there a high level of customization where we're going to need to develop that in-house? I'm happy to go back and try and find what information I can. I would say, though, in terms of a causal relationship, that consolidation hasn't meant more or less in terms of contracting. There have been some pretty substantial investments, though, that the legislature's made in the last couple years in terms of system upgrades or modernization that were, frankly, put off for many years before that and accrued a lot of, I think, what we would call IT debt. And those projects, in order to accomplish them in the given time frame, has meant bringing on staff augmentation, vendors to help us do development. But in other cases, such as I know the committee heard from the Department of Management and Budget last week about the fiscal note tracking system, there is no off-the-shelf solution or vendor who could meet the unique sort of processes that we have in terms of developing fiscal notes in the state. So in that case, it was internal .net. Development. It's really a case-by-case call. What's going to be most cost-effective? And Minute, as an organization, as a chargeback organization, we don't have a bias one way or another. We just want what's going to be most efficient and get the biggest bang for the buck for the state taxpayer dollar.
Representative Johnson, follow up?
Well, it sounds like you can go back and look.
I will.
And get that information. My expectation was consolidation would reduce the need, I guess, for contract research. So if you could provide me that information, I think that'd be great. And the committee, obviously, the chair. Thank you, Madam.
Madam Chair, will do. Thank you, Representative.
Representative
Nelson. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I got a couple of questions. One goes to the, you're talking about letting local governments piggyback on us, our procurement procedures. Is that any different than what we do as the local police departments use the state contract to purchase squad cars, local governments use the state contract to get that same price on all sorts of items across the board. So the procedure we use for that, is that any different from that procedure when we're talking about the services you're allowing the local governments to be able to procure through Minute?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, representatives, it's a very, very similar approach. It's
there. In fact, Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, they're managed in partnership with ADMIN, Department of Administration, Master Contract Program, ASAP IT Program is another one where agencies and local governments are able to bring on literally a person to fill a temporary role that's needed. So they're managed in the same way that the Master Contract, other Master Contracts, the Department of Administration manages.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The other question I have has to do with the question we had around MNSHR. And as I remember it, in the 2011-2012 legislature, there was nothing being done before that was being, the law had already been passed at the federal level, that the legislature did nothing. In fact, the governor, in the report that we got yesterday from the state auditor, there was the Governor Pawlenty signed an executive order that no money would be spent on doing anything to set this up. Did that delay in helping getting the IT and spending money to get that design work done ahead of time, did that help cause some of the problems that started with the first year of MNSHR because you said there was a tight time frame, and yes, there was changes being made all the way up to August, but if we'd had a year and a half prior to that to do some of the design work, would some of those delays have been mitigated and problems been mitigated?
Well, Representative Nelson, as the commissioner highlighted earlier, it was more of an issue of the federal requirements and the timeline associated with that. I think if you're just getting the interpretation of the law in August, I can imagine that would cause a lot of problems for you. But, Commissioner, you would like to respond?
Madam Chair, Representatives. I think the legislative audit really tells the tale well, so I guess I'd refer back to Mr. Nobles and his team's work there. We could have always used time, and it would be difficult to speculate from my perspective. You know, would have that made an impact? As I became involved with DHS and I saw the tight time frames and the contractor we had at the time, anything that we could have done to get us more time to develop this product would have helped.
And Madam Chair, I would just add, I mean, just factually, that other states were able to access or applied for and access planning grant funds for exchange development earlier than Minnesota did. You know, impact on the overall project timeline and ability to deliver in October 2013, that's speculation. But there were planning grants that other states were able to access earlier. It's just factual.
And Mr. Eichten, when was that first, when did Dayton, he issued his executive order to get the first grant? When was that? Do you remember what the date was?
I believe it was 2011. I mean, it wouldn't have been before that. I believe it was fairly early in the administration, 2011 at some time.
Mr. Ullman's coming down to help.
I think that is in the oil without a bank. That over time in there.
Yeah.
Mr. Eichten.
As Mr. Ullman was saying, Madam Chair, I believe it is noted the exact date in the OLA's audit. This was, and I believe it was 2011.
So okay.
You can look to the audit. It would be there.
Okay. Representative Nelson, any follow-up?
No.
Okay. Just on that point, though, too, when did Minshew hire their first staff? Do you know that at all?
Madam Chair, I don't. I would defer to Minshew on that.
Okay.
Question.
And how about, do you know when the RFPs were issued? Because that would have involved your minute staff.
Madam Chair, all that would be in the audit, literally all those time frames. In fact, the I wish I would have brought it with for that exact question. There's kind of a time module that the auditor laid out real well.
And Mr. Eichten?
Madam Chair, Minute was not a signatory on the RFP,
right,
just to be clear.
Do you know, though, when the contracts were signed at all or anything like that? Just in case it was on the top of your head, not that you would know for sure, but I just thought I'd ask. Okay.
I'm looking for phone a friend. I'm not getting an answer, Madam Chair. I apologize.
They're leaving you high and dry. Representative Kahn.
Well, one of the worst things, Madam Chairman, one of the worst things that I think that was done was that the not informing people right away that they could take a paper route, that they didn't have to keep trying to use the, the servers and everything like that. Mm-hmm. And that was just, and it was the feds didn't do it, the state didn't do it. And that was pretty bad. And talking about the problems that other states are having, apparently Oregon has just totally canceled its state one, gone to the federal one. I have a daughter who lives there who called me up and started screaming about all this, and I told her to contact her state legislator. No matter what she felt, I wasn't her state legislator. So we'll see. So we'll see what happens. We'll see what happens there.
Yeah, well, all of this transpired before legislation, so these were kind of the things that were happening behind the scenes. Members, any other questions at all? Okay, I just want to say thank you to Mr. Eichten. I know you're expecting your first baby.
Thank you.
Oh, how many weeks? I hope I'm not embarrassing you too much.
No.
I'm a mom.
She'll be arriving in late May, early June.
Late May, early June. Yeah. So you'll have a Father's Day.
I will.
That's absolutely exciting.
I'm pretty sure.
Congrats to you on that.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll wait till you're done saying goodbye to our guests, but just a quick comment.
Okay. I don't think there are any more questions. Thank you for coming today. We'll look for the email on all the questions that we asked. Members, I did want to point out that the in your folder are new spreadsheets for you. One you can put into your binder, if you would. This is with the updated information from the forecast. So take a look at those so you can see where the changes are. And we'll go from there. And then Representative Johnson, you had a comment that you would like to make.
Yes, Madam Chair. I've served as chair as well in different committees, and I know when we request for follow-up information, it comes slow or it doesn't come or whatever. And I'm not sure I've gotten all the information that's been requested, and that might be just because that's the way life is. But any thoughts on that? Is there? Have you seen that too?
I am, actually. In fact, MMB sent me an email, I think this was on either Thursday or Friday night, and one of the requests that I made is for getting the details of the managerial plans. And that was, you guys know I requested that a long time ago. And so they came back and said they are trying to figure out a faster way to get it to me. So one of the options that they provided is rather than giving the actual individual pay amounts, they would give me the ranges, but that doesn't really get at the issue that I was looking for. So I've been thinking on it and figuring out if there's another means. I was going to talk to Ms. Roberts too. I was also going to talk to our own HR people to see if there is a maybe they're misunderstanding what I'm looking for too, so I want to make sure that I put it in the right terms. Other data that we've had get forward, what was it? There was one the other day that will be in your folders tomorrow that you'll be able to look at. But much of it is just we haven't received the information.
Okay, I just wanted to bring it to your attention. I figured that was the case, and we obviously expect to get all that information too. So thank you.
And if nothing else, you know, at some point they'll be back at the table and, you know, I'll say I don't have the information. So it doesn't, you know, I'm sure hopefully it's just an issue that they haven't been able to put
in. Very good. Yeah, it's just an FYI.
Yep. Thank you. Members, any other questions or comments for the good of the order, as Representative Davids would say? If not, we are adjourned. Thank you.